You're listening to The Best of the Sports Company with Sean Fox, an on-demand audio presentation of RedPeachSports.com and ESPN977.com. Now, today's show.
It is Tuesday. It's 3:30. Time to talk to Andrew Hughes from the Saints Nation. What's up, pal? How are you?
Sean, you're punctual today. You're keeping things tight.
It's rare.
I like it.
It's very, very – I can't promise it'll ever happen again.
Is this a new you?
I just haven't had an epic long rant yet. It's coming.
It's
don't
coming.
Worry. I've got Brandon Doo-Doo Browner and Rob Ryan to talk about.
I love it.
We'll save those for last. We've been talking the last couple of weeks about Andrews Pete and our expectations of him this year. We thought it was crucial to justify that pick that he starts along that offensive line. And obviously we weren't the only ones who felt that same way. As Coach Payton has already come out and said after the first OTA, he expects Pete to be a starter this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And for now, he's been rotating with the guards. Now it looks like, at least through the first few OTAs here, it's been Andres Pete and Senio Calamete starting at the guard position. Now listen, long way to go. I wouldn't read too much into that. As you know, there's a lot of moving around, a lot of reps to be had at a lot of different positions. That doesn't mean that Tim Melito is in the mix. In fact, I would say he's one of the favorites to get one of those starting guard positions. But I think at least for now, obviously Zach Strief, a captain, a leader on this team, until he's ready to relinquish that role at right tackle, he's kind of penciled in as a starter over there for now, which means Andres Pete, if he's going to start, probably needs to go at guard, at least until an injury or a declining play happens. Obviously, I think Andres Pete in the future is probably a bookend tackle with Armstead, but how he gets on the field right now is most likely a guard. And I think if he has a whole training camp of practicing there and getting the reps and acclimating himself to the position, I think it will start to become pretty clear that he's one of the best alternatives one of the best options on the team on the roster at guard.
You know, as the end of last year, we all kind of thought Zach Strief was going to be out and this was mm-hmm. going to be Pete's spot at right tackle starting this year. And it doesn't look to be the case. And Coach Payton and, I guess, even more important, Drew Brees have that confidence in Zach Strief. But I do think, yes, eventually he will be the starting right tackle of this squad. As long as he's starting and being productive for me, justifies that pick from last year.
Absolutely. I think it starts with him being on the field and being productive. That's what you expect out of your first-round picks. You expect them, listen, not every first-round pick is going to make the Pro Bowl, but when you draft a player in the first round, if he's not becoming a quality starter for you at some point early in his career, then that's when these labels of bust and disappointment come out. There's a lot of expectations. There's a lot of financial commitment that come along with picking a player in the first round. And listen, the way things have gone, Sean, and with the cap space the way it is for the Saints in the last few years, they really can't afford to miss in the first round. And they've been fortunate, obviously, with Brandon Cooks. As bad as some of these drafts have been, Patrick Robinson and Malcolm Jenkins, you can kind of point to those as first-round picks that have been disappointing. But, as bad as the Saints have been in drafts, and you look at these last few first-round picks, Mark Ingram, Cameron Jordan, Brandon Cooks, Stephon Anthony, a lot of these guys you feel pretty good about, Kenny Vaccaro. There is, with these first-round picks in recent years, kind of a start of a building block for the team, which they can kind of start their core around and build from there. And so, this team isn't going to have Drew Brees forever, and it's going to be important to continue to build on this roster with solid first-round picks. And certainly you hope this year Sheldon Rankins will be no exception.
Well, speaking of Drew Brees, his contract at the softball tournament Tim Lolito put on, he pretty much put on a deadline to the Saints without putting on a deadline, saying he's not going to negotiate during the season. So what? We've got about 2 months, 2.5 months to get something worked out.
Yep, exactly. I think it's one of those things where it probably doesn't happen, honestly, until the season's over. And I think the Saints are prepared for that, and the writing's on the wall that this may not be something they tackle until next season, and so next offseason, I should say. And so then, you know, you start to get into territory of should they franchise tag him. It feels like it's too expensive, so they probably wouldn't. Do they risk pushing this to the 11th hour where Drew Brees might be tempted to try his fate with free agency and entertain offers from other teams? Certainly you don't want him to go that route, but this kind of feels like that's where it's headed at this point.
What would you consider, and of course Luke McCown in his one start last year against Carolina played about as good as you could expect Luke McCown to play, considering the situation. If anything happens to Brees, you realize that you've got a capable hand. But what do you consider the chances the Saints didn't go out and get another pick this year at quarterback, which means they're going to stick with Garrett Grayson? What would you put the odds as we go through the first OTAs in about 100 days from the start of the NFL season to Grayson beating out McCown as the number two this year?
Oh, I'd say less than 50%, definitely. I mean, I think, again, you look at McCown, he's a guy that's been there. He started in the league. I think he's learned a lot from Brees himself. I think, you know, listen, there's a lot of quarterbacks out there when they're young, and you say, yes, you hope that they will study under Drew Brees. But sometimes it's that 8, 9, 10-year veteran who's been around the league a long time that picks up things even quicker and learns from an elite quarterback. And I think you mentioned that Carolina start. How much McCown has improved from a play standpoint from when he was a young quarterback in the league, when it was in Cleveland or Tampa Bay and getting starts. And I feel like he's come a really long way. We've seen that really in preseason too, just with his command of the huddle in training camp, how comfortable he's been with this offense. And so I think McCown is a very underrated player on this team. And I think for how much the Saints pay him, they get a tremendous amount of value out of him as a backup. And you know, he's the kind of leader and quality person that you want in your locker room. And so it's going to take, in my opinion, an exceptional performance by Garrett Grayson for the Saints to feel comfortable letting McCown go and going with just two quarterbacks on the roster, with Grayson being the second. So, you know, I put it maybe at 25%, but I think it's going to have to be a combination of McCown performing average in preseason and training camp, and Grayson really turning our heads with some incredible performance.
Personally, I do feel, though, that he's going to get every opportunity to win that job this preseason, because they know what they have in Brees. They clearly know that they have with McCown. I think he will be the one to get the majority of the reps this preseason.
Oh, absolutely. No, he's the one that, like you said, there's a lot of comfort and there's a lot of understanding with what they have in their two veterans. And the big unknown is Grayson. So he's going to get all the reps. He's going to get a number of opportunities here. He'll be playing full halves of games, I expect, in preseason to get as many reps as possible and get a chance to show what he can do.
So I'm sure you've already addressed this. I know you have, in fact, on your website, The Saints Nation. Brandon Browner, when he first left the Saints, he had some rather kind things to say about the city of New Orleans and the fans. Not so much now. Doo-doo, not very kind. And I quote, took his millions and ran out of the city of New Orleans.
Yeah, that's disappointing. You know, certainly when I saw that, I was surprised that Browner would stoop to that level. And, you know, I think two things. First of all, I think it's important to realize context here, that this was a post on Instagram where he was being viciously attacked. And I mean, if you see the kind of stuff and the kind of mentions that he gets on social media on a daily basis from Saints fans, this guy is constantly getting killed. And for the most part, he doesn't respond or he takes it somewhat graciously. But on Instagram, he was responding to a fan. And, you know, in this day and age in social media, you say one thing and it gets out there and it's plastered everywhere. And certainly a poor choice of words for him at that point. So I don't want to make more out of it than it really is. But at the same time, when you look at Browner, a veteran, a guy that's been in the league for a long time, he's been a captain. He was a captain for the Saints last year. You just expect more out of guys like that. And whether he's with the Saints or not, any kind of insinuation that he maybe didn't care or that he was just in it for the money or that he wasn't trying or anything like that, which I don't believe to even be true, first of all. I do think the effort was there with Browner. I think he was injured, and I think he was put in a bad position due to injuries. and he's clearly declined in his play. But it really is just disappointing, Sean. And I think when you look at the Saints and you look at the comments made by Browner and you look at the comments made by Rob Ryan, I mean, those were the guys at the top. And that was your defensive coordinator, and that was your captain. And I think when you've got guys at the top that get kicked to the curb and then say things like that, it maybe gives you a little bit of insight into maybe they didn't have the right people there, because, you know, if this is the kind of character, if these are their true colors, then it makes sense why teammates wouldn't want to play hard for them or with them. And so, listen, these are paid professionals, and you expect more, and it's just unfortunate to see this come out. It just comes off like sour grapes and makes them look bad, honestly.
Well, I will say this. In Brandon Browner's defense, although I do think he's one of those athletes who probably shouldn't be on social media, I know here I am judging a guy for doing that and telling him what he should or should not do, but reading some of his posts in the past, maybe he's one of those guys who shouldn't press send. However, social media is great in a lot of ways, but one thing I really don't like about it is how it's so easy for trolls, and that's what they are, to just go on and say things to you like a professional athlete or just anybody, and say things on a keyboard when they know there's not going to be any repercussions, and say something to them that you would never say to them in person. Listen, Brandon Browner sucked. We all know that. Well, what's the point of constantly going on to social media and reminding him of that? What gratification are you getting out of it?
Yep.
And it's not Brandon Browner. That's social media in general.
And he's human. I think there's only so many times that you can expect someone to take until they start to push back. And, you know, he's gotten the bare brunt of it more than anyone else. But I will say this, Sean, and we discussed this last night on the podcast that we have on the Saints Nation. You know, Jason David, for as much as this guy was reviled in New Orleans and for as much as he was killed on a consistent basis for poor performance, I've got to give credit to that guy, because he stood there to the media, to the reporters, and every time he was asked about his poor play on the field, he took it like a man. He answered every question. He stayed in his locker room after the games and talked about how he needed to get better and it was his fault. And, you know, I have a tremendous amount of respect for Jason David, regardless of how he performed as a Saint. And I know he's the butt of a lot of jokes in Saints history.
Yes, he is.
But that's, you know, when guys are struggling, that's the kind of character you want. And, you know, that's one thing where, you know, Brandon Browner, maybe the performance is similar, but the reaction afterwards is not what you like to see out of a professional.
Here's the thing. Our running joke was Jason the Natural Disaster David, because it was terrible. Freddie Toast Thomas. But Brandon Doo-Doo Browner made Freddie Toast Thomas look like Deion Sanders this past year.
He did.
Okay, so I just wanted to make sure to get that out of the way, but I'm noticing a trend. We really haven't had a great history of defensive backs, particularly cornerbacks, in New Orleans. The fact that Toy Cook and that guy was bashed has to be considered one of our best cornerbacks we've had.
It's sad. No, I mean, and, you know, Eric Allen's one that really wasn't that great in New Orleans. But
he was okay. He wasn't as good as Philly. He was just okay, and that makes him really good.
That's right. I think at the end of the day, it's funny to me that, going back to Jason David, I mean, he was kind of maybe one of the most hated Saints players of all time. And then in just two short years between what's transpired with Junior Gillette and now what's transpired with Brandon Browner, David is almost a forgotten guy. Like, he's kind of come off now. He's smelling like roses. So I know he's got to be very thankful of what's been happening the last 2 years. But, you know, another bad egg, and I know the Saints were very careful about taking on character problems. By all accounts, Browner was supposed to be a leader, a guy that you want your young players around. And it's just really unfortunate how it all played out.
Well, and on that note, we'll go the unfortunate how it turned out with Rob Ryan. We love his personality. I think he fit New Orleans. We all wanted it to work, and in year one it didn't. He was he was the talk of the town. In fact, you could say his popularity rivaled Sean Payton, if not more. And what was the infamous thing we saw every week, whether you're in the Superdome or on TV, was the two guys dressed as Rob Ryan and Sean Payton. And again, he was the toast of the town. But he gets let go, where like he has everywhere else he's been. And when the defense is successful, he's taking credit for it. And when it sucked, and if we go through the history of his career, it has a lot, it's everybody else's fault.
Yeah, again, I think it's just you have to be better than that, regardless of whether it's true. Now, I do think there are some things that Rob Ryan threw out there that are probably fair comments. The misuse of Jarris Bird, decimating their ability to compete by investing all their money in one player. There's a lot of truth to that. And I do believe in some ways the lack of identity has really hampered this defense's ability to be successful. And when you say you're making a scheme change to a 3-4 defense, but then, and forget the Junior Gallette stuff off the field. I'm talking on the field. He is schematically a poor fit for a 3-4 defense. But you make that switch, and then you immediately extend him to a long-term deal right after that. And it suggests that he shouldn't have gotten that contract if they were committed to sticking with a 3-4 defense. And then you just look at the personnel that they've drafted, and to me, again, it's just, first of all, you have to define your identity. And once you define your identity, then you can develop young players because they understand where they fit within that scheme. And I think there's just been so many changes. And Sean Payton has oscillated between being very hands-off with Greg Williams, Steve Smagnola, and then having those negative experiences and then being very hands-on with Rob Ryan. And so I just think there's been too many changes. I think the one constant in New Orleans over these last 10 years has been the offense. There are going to be multiple, lots of scheme changes, lots of audibles, personnel changes. Sean Payton is going to be a high-volume passing team with accurate passing that gets the ball out quickly. And that's always been, there's been changes throughout. Drew Brees has been the only one that's been there the whole 10 years, really, but there's been changes all around him. But that offense has always been successful, and they've been aggressive. And the defense just has never held on to any kind of personality or style of play. And so I think, now again, you go back to these first-round picks that I was talking about, Cameron Jordan, Sheldon Rankins, Kenny Vaccaro, Stephon Anthony, and now you're starting to get these first-round players on defense that are pretty good. And if you can start to build a few more and develop an identity on defense, to me, that's what's critical, because as these players leave over time, if you have a good foundation that new young players can come in and understand and kind of craft their abilities around that personality, then it's easier for them to get better quicker. And so I think that's what's so important for the Saints defense over the next 2 years, to really understand who they are and commit to it.
I love what you've done, some of these features on the website recently. Tell folks about the all-decade teams you've done.
So, yeah, these all-decade teams are just obviously the 60s through 2010s, and it's the top 10 players through those decades. And so, it's kind of a look back at some of the great Saints players in history, and certainly in 2000 and 2010, you've got playoff winners, Super Bowl winners, so the quality of the roster was maybe better overall. So harder to get in the top 10, but certainly it's always nice to take a look back into the 60s and 70s and see some of those players that just don't get enough credit because of the lack of success of the team. The Saints history is rich, and I think there's a lot of special memories and a lot of special players over the course of the year, so always nice to take a look back.
Well, ironically, since we're doing that, since we've been talking, the Saints have tweeted out, this is pretty interesting, build your own Saints Mount Rushmore. Four players in Saints history off the top of your head. This is tough. We're going to do this here on the show in just a few minutes. Where would you go?
Well, I think the first three are undebatable. I think Brees, Ricky Jackson, Willie Rowe.
Yep.
That's your top three without question.
I'm with you.
So then number four, you've got, does Archie Manning belong? Does Deuce McAllister belong? Morton Anderson, Sam Mills, Pat Swilling. I mean, you've got a lot of guys, Marcus Colston. I think there's a lot of guys that are really close for that fourth spot. If you ask me today, I'm saying Morton Anderson. But I think all those guys I just mentioned have a case to be the fourth guy on there.
Tell folks about the website.
Thank you. It's thesaintsnation.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at SaintsNationBLG.
Appreciate you, pal. Talk to you next week.
Thanks, Sean.
Andrew Hughes, everybody. Saints Nation.
Sitting out in the dugout with Louisiana Tech head baseball coach Greg Goff is coach, man, NCAA tournament. First time in nearly 30 years. It's unbelievable to be thinking about. I'm sitting here, you guys, we're about to be June 1st. You guys are out here practicing still. It's unbelievable, but I want to bring you back. I had the chance to sit down with you last Thursday before your series versus Rice, or Thursday before last. And I told you kind of since I've been associated with Louisiana Tech that we've had some good athletic feats, but it seems like right when Tech is going to be able to take that next step, I always see, no matter what the sport, it just doesn't seem to happen. And you told me, you probably don't remember this now, you said, Sean, we're going to win, and we're going to win big. And here we sit 2 weeks later. You, sir, did not lie. You went out and you hammered one of the top programs in the country. You swept Rice, and then it carried over into the Conference USA tournament, which you didn't win, but you certainly opened the eyes of the college baseball world. Just kind of tell me what the last 2 weeks have been like.
I tell you, Sean, it's been unbelievable. You know, I just get teared up. Just you talking about it just sends chills down my body to know at this time last year, I was sitting in that office recruiting, mad, and just motivated to get our team into a regional. And the good Lord has blessed us a year later with having an opportunity to continue to play. But it's just amazing what these kids have done over the last 4 or 5 weeks. If you had told me that we had swept Rice, beat them 4 out of 6 opportunities in the last 10 days, win 3 games at the tournament, I would have said you're probably crazy. These guys have done it. Our players and coaches have just continued to work hard, stay committed to the plan, stay focused on the goal at hand. And that was to get to a postseason. This is kind of like icing on the cake.
You know, there's sports cliches, but I always say cliches exist for a reason, about a team being in the zone. And offensively, you got guys out here practicing right now. Is that a cabbage ball or is that a baseball? Because they're looking at the ball like the size of a cabbage ball right now. What's gotten into these guys at the plate?
Well, you know, I really, two things. I really feel like Coach Wells, our hitting coach, has did a tremendous job with these hitters. Two things you got to be in baseball. You have to be prepared, and you have to be confident. And I think our guys went in because of Jake and what he's done and his aggressiveness and belief. He's very confident in what he does. I think our players are going to take after us, and I think he really, you know, invested in and told our guys and made them guys believe in our plan, and then they were confident about going. I mean, we beat a first-rounder. He will be a millionaire next week. He was knocked out. He did not throw 5 complete innings against us, Sean, and just continued all the way through.
Yep.
I mean, Rice was the #1 pitching staff in our league, and I think we scored double digits on those guys almost
all but one game. Yep.
And, again, it just takes a lot of confidence. It takes a lot of preparation to attack that. I mean, we hit balls hard. I think one game we hit 4 home runs down there, so – it's just an amazing time. I hope we can continue that momentum as we go in the start. Well, if we can keep that momentum offensively with the pitching that we have, there is no doubt in my mind we can go over and have a chance to win that thing.
These guys don't quit. No matter what the score, no matter, I guess, the situation, even when guys may have quit on you, maybe some fans thought it was over with, you guys continue to prove people wrong. In fact, you were telling me that even some people associated with the Conference USA tournament are like, they just cannot believe that will not quit attitude you guys seem to exhibit week in and week out, especially this past 2 weeks.
Well, you know, some of the biggest compliments that we've gotten over the last few days have come from umpires. And as you know, that is so important to have those guys respect what we do. And, man, they just talked about how resilient this team has been. How they never quit, and it's just amazing the fight that these guys have got. And I think it all comes down to, you know, our guys love one another, they respect one another, and they have a desire and a passion to try to win.
Is this, I mean, and I know this is a tough spot to put you in, but you mentioned how much these guys like each other, and I noticed the attitude these guys have, and they rally around each other. There's a bunch of guys already out here at practice when they probably don't have to be yet. Is this one of the closest-knit teams you've been a part of?
No doubt. This is by far one of the closest teams I've ever coached. I had a couple that I had at Canwell that were real close, and they won a bunch of games. I think that's so important when you get an 18- to 22-year-old kid to get away from himself and his individual stats and really buy in to the program first mentality, the power one mentality. And I tell you what, Sean, every one of these kids have bought in. I mean, we got Tyler Clancy, our number one pitcher. He's doing charts. Sean Ulrich, one of our leading hitters, he's doing a chart in the dugout, cheerleading our team. How much more can you say about what these kids are giving for the betterment of this team?
And it's just kind of one of those things where mojo in baseball is weird. You may have a guy who's seeing the ball extremely well right now. I know you have some guys batting 891, 566, but also guys and situations may have been 0 for 8, 0 for 9, but in a big spot this past weekend, they came up and got a hit.
No doubt. Big time. Big time. You know, Cody, we're watching him hit right now. He had been struggling up until this weekend, hit 4 home runs. Garrett Dodd, pinch hits, force, has 2 or 3 base hits. He even starts the game, has 2 hits. Matt Holcomb, another guy that's been real successful for us. Rafael Gladue, you know, he didn't even start all the games against Rice. The first when we played him on Friday, he didn't even start. Came in, got the big pinch hit home run. He got all of a sudden is all conference down there. I mean, it's just amazing the amount of kids. Taylor Love, look at his batting average. He's hitting, I don't know, 2-something over the year. I bet he's hitting over 350 in the last 5 or 6 games.
I know how much of a competitor you are, and I know you're probably locked in the game. But these games with Rice have been unstinking believable and unreal, and you've seen just about everything in these series. Is there a point, like, after the 4th or 5th game, you guys are playing each other, and you get down big or they're down big, and one team is coming back, or there's a fluke play, where you just take a second and just laugh? Just say, this is just, what else can there be?
No, I don't laugh too much in the game. You know, we're pretty locked in.
Yeah, I know you're locked in, but it has been one of the strangest 6-game series. First of all, to play them 6 times, but just the way this thing has kind of played out.
It really has, and I think Coach Graham got tired of looking at us, and, you know, he didn't even shake my hand after the game that we beat him in, that first game on Saturday. You know, so I just think that, you know, we this group has wanted to win so bad. They just don't let anything get in their way. And I just think that, man, they've just been locked in for 27 outs. It's just tremendous. I mean, you just don't see that in baseball. People talk about your highs and your lows and all this team. This team plays and brings high level every single day.
Your fan support here, we talked about it before the Rice, the first game. You said, we're going to need you, and they answered the call. They were tremendous for this Rice series, and a lot of them went this past weekend to Hattiesburg. But you would expect that from, I guess you would call the traditional Tech fans, may have graduated from Tech or from this area. But to me, I told you, one of the biggest compliments I think about your club is people who were not necessarily Louisiana Tech fans who have kind of, hey, listen, jumped on the bandwagon, and he'll gladly take them.
No doubt.
I told you the story of a guy who is an LSU graduate. He's one of the biggest LSU fans I know, making a point to buy a radio, not to listen to the LSU broadcast while he was in Hoover. He was listening to your team while at the SEC tournament. He's that locked into what you guys are doing right now.
That's just amazing.
I've heard countless stories like that.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, people have a lot of respect for people that play hard and you know, hustle out. You know, we were making fun of some, not making fun of them, but just, you know, saying things in our dugout about watching Rice and some of their players. They'd hit a ground ball and they'd halfway run down the first, and our players, you know, yeah, look at that. And then, you know, maybe we get hit by a pitch and you hear our players, we hold our ground. Other guys are moving out of the way and they're yelling, yeah, look at him, coach, he's moving this. I just think that a lot of people just take pride in doing the little things that we do, that our players are doing on a daily basis. That's just fun to watch, you know, and that's what I want our players to be, great role models and examples for little kids coming up, that their fathers and their grandfathers and their moms and dads and stuff can say, hey, you need to play like those guys.
Let's go back to yesterday, the NCAA tournament selection show.
Wow.
Great crowd out here at the Davidson Athletic Complex to see your team, which, again, doesn't surprise me because you guys have captivated a lot of people.
Yeah.
But when you don't win your conference tournament, you're kind of at the mercy of the NCAA selection committee. And we all have been studying. Heck, I had trouble sleeping the night before. I can't imagine what you were like, but I'm sitting there at midnight. Okay, D1 Baseball says, hey, before the end of the night, we're going to have our final projection list. And I'm like, okay, well, it's midnight. You guys still haven't done it. And I couldn't sleep until I finally saw it.
I was the same
and
way.
And you guys were in the back. A lot of it is, again, it's kind of guessing, but they're pretty good at doing this.
Right.
Either LSU or TCU was kind of four or five different regionals within Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, you guys could have ended up with. That LSU Baton Rouge regional pops up, and you guys aren't on it. Anything going through your mind right
now? Oh, yeah. You know, once I saw the Baton Rouge, I really thought we would go to Baton Rouge. I didn't think we'd go to Lafayette. You know, we'd been there, and we'd played them twice and beat them, and I just didn't think they would send us to Lafayette. But I felt like LSU or TCU was really the two that they were. And then I saw the LSU go down, and we wasn't there. Then the TCU, you know, not there. I started to really be concerned, Sean. You know, I'm holding my wife's hand, and next thing I know, she's driving my hand because my hand's sweating so bad. I really started getting nauseated at the fact that I was like, you know, watching our players put their cameras up, ready to take a picture of seeing our name up there. And the excitement, and then
let me stop you there before we get there. Unfortunately, you experienced something like this a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I know, yes, it hurts for you, but I know the main thing that was going through your mind, you were going to hurt.
That's right.
For these kids.
No doubt. And I still have those feelings for that team, 49-10. being told what we were
in. You're 49-10 and don't make it to the NCAA tournament.
You know, and people telling us we were in. Every projection had us in and all this kind of stuff. And I just knew I just didn't want our kids to hurt like that group did that day because we had the media there. We had everybody there.
Kind of what had you had
just like yesterday.
Yeah.
Just like yesterday. And I had to get I had to ask all the fans and media to get outside the doors and close the doors and just weep like a bunch of babies for 30 minutes or so and let those guys know that we wouldn't get a chance to play anymore. So I just did not want that to happen again. I knew what that feeling was, and I was just hoping and praying that we'd come somehow Louisiana Tech would be up on the board.
Well, it finally happened. Starkville, Mississippi pops up. You were pretty emotional.
I was.
So take me through it.
You know, when you work and you make a commitment and so many sacrifices goes into our lives as coaches and, you know, picking my family up and coming here after leaving a great place that we loved at Campbell and, you know, coming here and taking your daughters out of school and bringing in coaches and all those things, Sean. It's just, you know, I don't really think that everybody understands the sacrifices that we make. And, you know, the biggest ultimate goal is to get to the postseason, get to a regional, see your name on Memorial Day weekend flashed up there and you know, all those things, you know, the moving and the sacrifices and all that stuff just kind of comes to a head. It's just very emotional to me. You know, I put my heart and soul into what I do. I thank the good Lord every day that I'm, you know, 46 years old and I've never had to work a day in my life. And, you know, I'm just so thankful and it's just so amazing. And all those emotions just hit. And, you know, I just want to praise God to give me an opportunity to do what I do every day.
I know it had to be a long 48 hours, so probably not a whole lot of sleep until you finally. Now, did you sleep last night, or are you so excited you couldn't sleep last night?
You know what? I told Tina, I'm like, okay, I got to go lay down. I tried to go lay down about 9:30, and my phone just kept. I finally just had to turn my phone off. And once I got to sleep, I got to rest. But as soon as the sun came up this morning, about 5:35, I was up, you know, excited. I knew I had so many things we had to do today with travel and practice and all those things. And, you know, it is just amazing all the things we're having to do. So that's a good thing.
I know it would have been a great accomplishment to win it as the conference tournament champion. And I know that is the goal going forward. But I think it's an unbelievable testament to not just – your squad, but five teams in the state of Louisiana to make it to the NCAA tournament. That's the most outside of Texas, and clearly Texas is a little bit bigger than Louisiana to make it, but make it as at-large teams.
No doubt. I think it says a lot for the state of Louisiana, the baseball that's going on, the high school coaches and the travel teams, all the things that are going on in the state right now, Sean. And I knew that when I came. I felt like this would be a place that you could get a lot of homegrown kids and be really competitive within the state. And, you know, I think you may saw an interview I had last year. You know, my goal is to just get Louisiana Tech in the mix of all those other teams because I have so much respect for the LSUs and the Lafayettes and the Southeasterns and the McNeeses and the Northwestern States and Monroe, all those guys that have been so successful in baseball. And, you know, I'm just so glad that we're here, and now we're being able to be mentioned with some of those guys.
Well, now we're headed to Starkville, Mississippi, one of the greatest environments of college baseball. Woo. You're going this weekend. Let's start. I'm going to get you a little bit of a scouting report from you from everybody, but let's start with the team you're going to play on Friday night, and that has been a change over the last few hours as it went from the early game to the late game. Which is going to help with your crowd getting over there. I think you're going to have a great crowd come over from Northeast Louisiana. But for those who might not follow college baseball quite a bit, Cal State Fullerton, never even heard of that school. This is actually one of the premier programs in all of college baseball. And they seem to make a home in Omaha in the 80s and 90s. And while they might not be that, they are still one of the best teams that you're going to see in an NCAA tournament every single year.
Well, it was funny. I was looking at their stuff last night. My daughters were in my office, and we were talking. And I was like, Dad, who's Fullerton? And that's what most people, they don't know because they're not a football school. They don't have football. But they are a baseball giant. They are, highly respected. They're probably one of the best teams, if not the best team on the West Coast,
that
if you look back at their
something.
History.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and, Coach Vanderhook is a tremendous coach. You look at the coaches that have gone, that have been there. George, Augie Garrido, George Horton, Dave Serrano, all those guys.
Who's who of college baseball
have coached there. And Coach Vanderhook has been there for a long time as an assistant and now running that program. And they are the cream of the crop from the West Coast. So they will be very, very good on the mound. Their pitching numbers, Sean, listen to me, 2-point-something ERA for their staff. That's unheard of. That's got to be maybe top two or three, maybe number one in the country.
Now, and this seems to be like kind of the West Coast there, and it's kind of like football where there's kind of different versions of ball played. West Coast football, same thing with baseball.
Yeah.
Are they more of a small ball, station to station type of team?
Yeah, they're going to put a lot of pressure on you. They're going to be fundamentally, they're going to be pitching and defense oriented. They'll have a couple of guys in the middle of the order that can really hit with power, but most of their guys are going to be, you know, runners, bunters, hit and run, a lot of skill type stuff is really what we're trying to prepare ourselves for.
And then you're the four seed is like a 40-win team as well?
I think our region is the toughest one.
I agree.
You look at the RPIs of all four teams, it's amazing. Southeast Missouri, I worked there for 2 years.
Okay, you're familiar with it.
So people don't even know. That's really not even been out yet. But I left Delta State and was a pitching coach for Mark Hogan, which is retired now, for 2 years there. And so I know all about Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and I know about the Red Hawks, they can really, really swing it. They have one arm that's really legit. He'll throw against Mississippi State on Friday afternoon now. He is tremendous, but they can really, really score. So it may be a 20-21 game if we hook up with them guys.
Well, and then you've got Mississippi State, who, I mean, what can you say about this program? they've been a baseball school for a long time. Will Clark, Rafael Palmeiro, they've put a ton of major leaguers, and some say this may be the best team they've had.
Yeah.
That's saying something. You could start with the bats. They've got plenty. You could start with the pitching. You're going to see some millionaires this weekend. But you just have had your way with the best pitching staff at Conference USA. So I don't think you guys are going to fear any pitchers they're going to see this weekend.
I don't think so. I think Coach Wells will have a great plan. You know, that's what we're doing now, trying to prepare in our war room back there and just try to get our hitters ready to go. We're going to come out today and have some small groups with hitters and start focusing on what we feel like Fullerton's going to do. I hope we get a shot to play Mississippi State. I hope, you know, that'd be a tremendous opportunity and a great game. Coach Cohen's been there for a while, Coach Polk, the legendary coach really to me is the godfather of college baseball, especially in the South. And
those cowbells.
Oh my gosh, I'm having nightmares about them. it's just a great fan base over there. They love the Bulldogs, it'll be a great environment for our players to walk into.
I know you're focused on Cal State Fullerton, but how much in tournaments like this, because you just had to do in the Conference USA tournament as well, how much planning ahead can you do for a potential opponent the next day?
Yeah, we'll have a whole folder on each team. That's what we're doing right now. We're going out and getting reports on every team because you don't know who you're going to play. And so and we're watching video of all the teams that we can. And so that's what we're doing right now. We're just trying to accumulate all that we can and then come up with a great report. And then whoever we play, that's what we'll go with.
What's your rotation looking like this weekend?
You know, we haven't decided. It'll be Sutton or Deal. it really do, it depends on, again, how many left-hand hitters, how many right-hand hitters that Fullerton will have. If it's a more dominant left-hand hitting team, then we'll throw Deal. If it's more of a right-hand hitting team, we'll throw Sutton. So it really depends on, and I think we'll probably make that decision sometime today.
Your guys have played a lot of baseball the last week. How are we on the injury front headed this weekend?
Well, I feel like we've gotten some progress. We feel like that, you know, J.D. Perry's back. Marshall Boggs will be back this weekend. Sean Owerts hopefully will be back and be able to swing the bat. We're hoping, you know, Tyler will be able to help us on the mound some. He's seeing a doctor again today. So all those things we're trying to work out and see exactly who's going to be healthy. But I feel good about it.
You've brought a lot of baseball fever to this area. I'm not ready for this thing to end.
I tell you what, that's the thing about when you go through the experiences that we have, Sean, is that you don't want it to end. And now that we are coming to a point where there's no more selection shows, it's win or go home. You know, I'm going to enjoy every day with this group of guys. And like I told them in the locker room yesterday afterwards, we're five games away from Omaha. We're five games away from Omaha.
I'll put goosebumps on you.
I mean, it's just amazing. We're that close. And I told them, man, let's work hard. Let's prepare, because we're five games away from reaching every dream we've ever had as a baseball player and coach.
I told you this before, and we'll leave with this. The amazing thing about college baseball is, again, the college football is kind of slanted to the power conferences.
Yeah.
College basketball, you may get a Cinderella story every now and then. College baseball is that one sport where Louisiana Tech, if you just get in, you've got a legitimate chance to win a national championship.
There is no doubt. And I love it. I love it. I love being the underdog. I love being that guy. I love having a team that not supposed to do it. And that's a great thing about baseball. You put somebody on the mound that can pitch, you play good defense, have some timely hitting, anybody can win.
Coach, it's been fun. I want to be sitting with you next week right here talking
yes.
about a super regional.
Yes, well, if we definitely continue to go over and play well, and, you know, we're superstitious. So we'll be right here next week, and just appreciate what you guys have done.
Absolutely.
I want to thank the crowd. I want to thank the fans that have come out and supported this. Thanks for everybody that came yesterday and the support. I am expecting a huge blue following.
Absolutely.
In Starkville. I want to take over Starkville and make it Techville this week.
I think Russ Vegas is going to invade Stark Vegas. So, Coach, best of luck this weekend, brother.
All right, man. Thanks so much, Sean.
It's time to preview the big Starkville Regional this weekend. And here to help us out, Joel Coleman from the Starkville Daily, our guest. Joel, appreciate the time, brother. How are you?
Man, I couldn't be doing any better. Glad you guys had me on here today.
Yeah, we appreciate you taking the time to join us. Okay, not to hit you out of left field, but before we get into the baseball, I do want to talk about something that's kind of been big news on the Mississippi State front. And one of the things about college-based basketball, that I really don't like is it's starting to feel that college basketball has kind of become like NBA free agency. And one of the big highlights of that has been maybe one of the top players who's going to transfer is from Mississippi State in Malik Newman, highly touted freshman last year. I know LSU was in the mix, the final mix for him. Could have picked any school in the country. Ended up with Ben Howland at Mississippi State. 1 year later, he's leaving. What went down?
You know, it's a situation that I spoke with Malik's father, Horatio Webster, just yesterday, and Horatio, for those that don't know, played his college basketball at Mississippi State, so there's a tie there, and spoke with Horatio about the whole situation, and basically it seemed like there's just a little bit of a trust issue there. You know, Horatio was really bragged on Ben Howland, called him a class act, you know, said that his resume speaks for himself. Really didn't seem like there was much bad blood there. But it was a situation where Horatio and Malik felt like he wanted to basically play the point, and he couldn't get that guarantee that if Malik came back to Mississippi State that he'd get to play the point. He was afraid that he would get stuck at the two-guard spot again, and that's not what he felt was best for Malik's development. That's not what Malik felt was best for his development. And so they just basically decided to part ways. It's kind of shocking with the way his recruitment went down, with Horatio being a Mississippi State guy. In fact, he ended our conversation yesterday by saying, I'm always going to be a Bulldog. So it's kind of I don't know. It's kind of odd. You know, you can read between some lines, maybe, and that sort of thing. As far as did they like Ben Howland, his coaching style, what have you? But that's kind of where things stood. I think that Malik really wanted to play the point. They couldn't get that guarantee, so they decided to go elsewhere and pursue other opportunities.
Is this one of those situations, though, where there's, you know, he's obviously been a star player for quite some time. Maybe there's some outside forces or some outside people. I hate to use the word handler, but involved in this situation?
I hate to use the word handler and things, too. You know, his father has, even before he came to Mississippi State, has always kind of handled a lot of his media interviews and things like that. And like I said, has Mississippi State ties, so everybody at Mississippi State is familiar with Horatio and things. So it's not like it's just some random, you know, person out there. I mean, it's his father who Malik loves and adores and things. So, I don't know. I've always kind of wondered how those situations work, too, as far as, you know, having other people handle your media opportunities and things, too. But this is his father, so I don't know. As far as all that goes, I do wonder who's giving him advice and things, and if Malik is getting to do what he wants to do kind of thing. That's questions that we'll never,
sure,
I guess, 100% know. But at least as things stand now, it sounds like they're on the same page. And if you look at some of Malik's tweets over the last couple of days, this doesn't sound like anything where Horatio's wanting one thing, Malik's wanting another. It seems like they're on the same page with this decision.
Last thing on this, because we got you on to talk a little baseball, but has there been, and a lot of times this happens, there's a list of restricted places. If you're going to get your release, you can't go. Have you heard where he may be going or places maybe he cannot go?
I have not. I can't speak on that just yet. I would find it hard to believe that he would be able to transfer to another Southeastern Conference school. I haven't heard that officially yet, but I would figure that would be the case, that you won't see him playing at another SEC school. And talking with Horatio yesterday, he said that there has been, to this point, no contact with other schools and things. I know that at least around these parts, some of the rumor mill has been, you know, does he end up at Western Kentucky? And, of course, that may sound out of left field for some, but Rick Stansbury is the head coach of Western Kentucky, who is, of course, the longtime head coach here at Mississippi State, and, you know, Coach Horatio and things. So there's been some talk that maybe he ends up there, but I specifically asked Horatio yesterday, has there been any contact, you know, any discussion? Is that in play? And Horatio said that he hadn't even talked to Rick Stansbury at all since Texas A&M. Of course, Stansbury was an assistant at A&M this past season. When A&M came to Starkville in January, he said that was the last time he had ever spoke to Stansbury. So that was kind of what the rumor mill, and that's just speculation. There was no, you know, nobody has said that kind of deal. That was just the first kind of school that was kind of thrown out there. But no, I don't know what schools he can't go to as of yet. Don't know, you know, what he's even looking at yet. If you'll go back to some of the schools outside the SEC maybe that he was looking at on the recruiting trail before he signed. All that kind of remains to be seen at this point.
All right, let's switch over to the baseball. Mississippi State with a proud baseball tradition. Yet some people saying this is one of the best. Where do you think, from talking to a lot of the Starkville names and longtime Mississippi State fans, where this team ranks?
It's got to be right up there with you know, one of the best ever. I guess the ultimate, you know, final chapter of that will be written over the next few weeks. But, this team has the most conference wins of any team in school history. And when you think back to the history of this program, 9 College World Series, you know, you've had teams in the late 80s that most consider the best teams in Mississippi State history. Those teams were Will Clark and Rafael Palmeiro and even John Cohen later on in the 80s played on those teams. But most of those are usually considered some of the best teams in Mississippi State history. I wasn't, you know, in 1989 when John Cohen was playing outfield for Mississippi State, I was 4 years old, so I didn't get to have a whole lot of experience with those teams. But in watching this team, it's hard for me to believe that they don't rank right up there, you know, in the top 5 teams in Mississippi State history. And of course, ultimately, whether or not that sticks will be how they do over the course of the next few weeks. But all the pieces are there. This team, they can pitch it, they can hit it. if they're down four runs, they have the sticks to get back in the game. That wasn't the case, you know, a year ago. This team was wretched a year ago, and to have the worst first run, win the conference title for the first time in 27 years, all the pieces are in place for them to really cement themselves as the best team in Mississippi State history. All that's yet to be seen, though.
What is the going back to the beginning of the year? I know I'm doing the play-by-play for Louisiana Tech, and you go back all the way to the very beginning of the year when you go through those midweek games and then the early weekend series against non-conference opponents that, you know, you kind of get to see the personality of the team a little bit. What do you feel like has changed or improved the most from all of that? And we know that SEC conference play is a completely different animal than that pre-conference season. What have you seen is the changes and then the biggest change from the mid-season where conference started to the end?
Well, it sounds odd to pin all this on one guy, but I'm kind of going to do that with the answer to this question. In the early part of the season, Mississippi State was, as they usually do, figuring things out, tinkering with the lineup a little bit. Then before conference play really got going, Jacob Robson, center fielder, he went down with a hand injury, and Jake Mangum, who ended up being the SEC Freshman of the Year, stepped in, and from that point on has just taken off. He led the SEC in batting average. I think he's third in the country in batting average. He's a guy that State has put at the top of their lineup, and from that point on, it really felt like that lineup came into place. I think the pitching was there all along. Dakota Hudson anchors the rotation. He's a first-round guy. You know, he's going to go in the first round of the MLB draft next month. It's still May, so next month he'll go in the first round of the draft. He's that type of one. Austin Sexton behind him is a guy that has been really consistent for Mississippi State as well. State's found a third starter that has been really consistent in Connor Pilkington. Just last week at the SEC tournament, Zach Houston came out through 8 2/3 innings before finally getting lifted after giving up one run in 8 2/3 innings. He's kind of their midweek guy now. So they have four or five guys that you can feel good about as a team to run out there from a starting pitching staff. And the bullpen, while young, is pretty deep as well. So the pitching's kind of always been there. But it really felt like with this team whenever Jake Mangum stepped in that leadoff role, whenever Jacob Robson went down. Of course, Robson's back now, so now they're both in the lineup. But whenever Mangum came in and solidified that leadoff hole, you know, batting .430, it seems like he's on base every single time up. Things just really started to click for this team. And it's, you know, like I said, it's kind of seems odd to put all this on one guy, a kid that was playing high school baseball a year ago at this time. But from that point on was really when this team took off.
Joel Coleman from the Starkville Daily, our guest here on the Sports Company, ESPN 97.7. Joel, the amazing turnaround you mentioned, this squad, impressive. But what is the most impressive to me, and we talk about the SEC, and justifiably so, the deepest conference in college baseball. And if you look at the national seeds, it's backed up. But winning 9 of the 10 SEC series they played in this year and sweeping the last 3 going into Hoover, absolutely incredible.
I don't even think that I've asked John Cohen this, I've asked Kendall Rogers of D1 Baseball this. You know, I've tried to find out, has there ever been a turnaround like this? I mean, obviously last year this team won 8 conference games. You know, 8-22 was their conference record last year. 8 conference wins last year. This team won 9 series. It's really remarkable. They're the very first team in the history of the Southeastern Conference to go from dead last to winning the SEC outright. Now, there's been a team before to go from dead last to tying for the league title the next year. That was actually Kentucky back in 2006, I believe. The head coach of that Kentucky team, John Cohen. So this is the second time that John Cohen has led a team from the cellar of the division to the peak the very next year. And it really is, you know, to watch last year's team and this year's team, it's just two completely different ball clubs. I mean, last year was a club, as bad teams tend to do, that they could just find ways to lose. Whether it was at Ole Miss, they were up by 5 runs with 2 outs in the 9th inning, and they found a way to lose that game. The last day of the season at Tennessee last year, they were up 2-0 in the 9th. They found a way to lose that game. they found a way to lose just about every game, as bad teams tend to do. And this team this year is right the opposite. I mean, that, at no point in just about any game do you feel like this team is out of it. It's a bunch of good guys. I was talking with one of our fellow beat reporters a few weeks ago. It's almost like covering a professional team with a professional approach. Just their maturity level, the things that they say, the way they look at the game. You got a guy like Nate Lowe that plays first base that was talking the other day about some hitting adjustments he made from watching the Yankees Red Sox game. He adjusted his stance a little bit. He went out the next game and went 5-for-5. I mean, this team just, they're very baseball savvy. They're a mature group. It's just been really incredible how this roster has turned over, and that's another part of it. I mean, there's so many new faces on this club as compared to a year ago, and all those pieces have just fell into place.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the roster a little bit because you have a good mixture of homegrown guys from Mississippi, but you also don't – you're not overloaded with junior college players, have a lot of high school freshmen on the team, but you also have a mix. As we know, there's different brands of baseball that's played all throughout the country. And you guys also, besides your homegrown and, you know, Alabama, Tennessee, Texas guys, you've got a good mixture of guys from different parts of the country as well. Just really, I think, a good mix of all of those aspects through that whole roster.
Absolutely, and it's guys that have been through the wars at different stages. You know, I mentioned Nate Lowe. He's a guy that a JUCO transfer, but before that he had played some college ball at Mercer. I mean, he's played at the D1 level. Jack Kruger, another guy that's hitting over 300, catcher slash DH for this club. He played ball out on the West Coast of Oregon. You've got guys like John Holland that plays second base. He played for Florida State at one point in his career. You have guys that you know, none of this is really new to them. There is nothing that these guys can really go through that they haven't experienced before. And then the kids that haven't been through it, like I mentioned a while ago, Jake Mangum, all he does is go out there and hit 430. So it's really been incredible. I think that, of course, some of Mangum's success can be, you know, given to the guys that hit behind him, the Nate Lowe's, the Krugers and guys that have been through it. But it's all just really been a perfect storm to this point.
Joel, a lot of people wondering, if you don't mind giving the reason, Louisiana Tech was slated to play the afternoon game when the brackets first came out. That's been switched. Now State, and obviously State gets the decision to pick the time. They're going to go the early game. I know LSU does this on a yearly basis when they host in Baton Rouge. They love to be that first game. What's the deal with Mississippi State? What's the decision to change the times?
You know, it's a decision that has made a lot of Mississippi State fans mighty unhappy up around Starkville and Jackson and wherever they are in the state. Most people, you know, were banking on having plenty of time to get to Starkville for a 6:30 game, and then last minute yesterday, everyone learned it changed to 1:30. John Cohen, actually, we met with John Cohen yesterday before that announcement came down, so we haven't had a chance to speak with him since then, but he did speak with Mississippi State, as a lot of programs do, kind of have their in-house reporter now. And he released an article this morning. He spoke with Cohen and Athletic Director Scott Strickland. And it was basically a move that John Cohen felt gave Mississippi State the best chance to be successful in the regional. You know, I guess you can debate that however you want to. And there's a whole lot of State fans that think, you know, he's crazy for thinking it that way. But his mindset on all this, according to the article, was basically that by going ahead and playing the early game, it allows State to take BP on their own field. You know, there's no chance of a game going long and not getting to take BP on the field. So they get to kind of maintain their regular routine at home. They get to continue to take that practice on the home field. Secondly, if there's any weather issues, any delays, anything like that, it means you're not playing baseball until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and then possibly losing the game and then having to come right back for a 1:30 game the next day. So there's that. And lastly, he likes the idea of being able to scout the other two opponents in the night game, you know, sitting there in the stands live at Duty Noble Field. Another component to all this, Southeast Missouri State, they have a ace left-handed pitcher who has somewhere around 145 strikeouts and 105 innings. I mean, he's a pretty pretty dominant arm, and he's a guy that threw 12 innings just last weekend, and I want to say somewhere in the neighborhood of between 160 and 180 pitches just last weekend. So by pushing the game up another 5-6 hours, that's 5 or 6 less hours to recover. Now, Cohen didn't say any of this. This is just Jordan
right.
speculating here.
Right.
But that 5 or 6 less hours to recover, he'll be pitching in the heat of the day, you know, here in, not saying Missouri's not humid too, but he'll be pitching in the heat of the day in a humid ballpark. Does he wear down a little quicker? I don't know. When you put all those components together, though, I think that's kind of the basis of John Cohen's decision. And it's going to mean, you know, several thousand less in the stands. Duty Noble has many times before had tens of thousands of fans crammed in there. I don't know that they get to the 10,000 mark playing a 130 game. We'll see. So it will definitely hinder some people from getting to the ballpark. But John Cohen felt it gave State the best chance to win to do it this way.
Well, I'm going to have to put you on two hats, the sports hat and now meteorologist. It looks like right now we should be okay on Friday, but it doesn't look so promising. And granted, it is the weather and it is Tuesday. A lot could change, but forecast doesn't look good on Saturday and Sunday as of right now.
Yeah, it doesn't. And you know, though, I've learned, especially this year, to not pay too much attention to that just yet, because earlier in the year when State played Oregon here at Duty Noble Field, there was, I think, 100% chance of rain every day, as close up to the game as like 24 hours out. They ended up playing every single one of those games right on time, no rain delays, no anything. You just never know, but you're right. As you look at it right now, it looks like weather could play a factor this weekend too, which like I said, I think is another reason Cohen wanted to go ahead and play that first game to make sure that at the very least State gets that first game in and hopefully dodges any weather issues that might roll in, whether it's late Friday night or whatever, and get State out of a chance of possibly playing a couple of times on Saturday or a couple of times on Sunday. I really feel like that was part of the whole decision-making process with what the forecast is.
Finally, it looks like, depending on website you're on, the toughest brackets or toughest regions are going to be in the state of Mississippi. It's either Oxford or Starkville as the toughest in the country.
Oh, no doubt. And, you know, State's a national seed for the first time. They've never done that before, and there's a number 6 national seed. But, you know, not exactly – they didn't exactly get any favors from the committee, like I mentioned earlier with Valley, you know, South Missouri State coming in and things. They're not a terrible team at all. They're not just your average 4 seed rolling into Starkville. And, of course, the rest of the field, you got a traditional power like Cal State Fullerton, who, you know, oddly enough, their pitching coach, Jason Dietrich, he actually looked like was going to be Mississippi State's pitching coach before the season when Butch Thompson left to go coach at Auburn. Dietrich was the favorite in Starkville. That kind of fell apart last minute. Both parties kind of said it wasn't going to work, and so anyway, State ended up hiring Wes Johnson. So there's kind of a storyline there between Mississippi State and Cal State Fullerton. There's a guy on Louisiana Tech staff, Jake Wells, that was a former coach of Mississippi State as well. So there's a little bit of tie there. And of course, Alex Missouri State, they have ace pitcher, pretty good 4 seed there. There's just storylines all around, and not to mention 4 really good clubs. If weather will hold off, I think it's going to be a really good weekend in Starkville, just for not Mississippi State fans, but just for baseball fans to tune in and watch.
Joel, great stuff, man. I know there's a lot of Tech fans in the area who want to know more about the Mississippi State Bulldogs. How can they find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter. My name with my middle initial in it, at Joel T. Coleman. I write for the Starkville Daily News. I have a blog. You can just search for the Starkville Daily News Bulldogs blog on Google, and you can find me that way, too. That's probably easier than me telling you the long website address. But I'd love to interact with anyone, answer any questions that anyone may have. I don't always have the answers, but I love the interaction.
Joel, I appreciate you, brother. We're going to stop by and say hello Friday at the game.
Sounds good. Look forward to it, guys.
Got it. Joel Cohen with the Starkville Daily. In-depth information on the Mississippi State Bulldogs.
Thanks for listening to the Best of the Sports Company with Sean Fox. To listen live every weekday, tune in at ESPN977.com or subscribe to the show in iTunes, on Stitcher, or at redpeachsports.com.